You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Caudette. As we continue to cover the coronavirus pandemic, we know so many people have questions and concerns. So many questions are coming into our Idaho Matters inbox recently regarding the vaccine and the new variants of the virus. So today we are going to do our very best to answer those questions with our medical experts. And if you have a question, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Joshua Kern, the Vice President of Medical Affairs for St. Luke's Magic Valley, and Dr. Patrice Burgess, Executive Medical Director for St. Alphonsus Health System and the Chair of the Governor's Vaccine Advisory Committee. Welcome to the program, everybody.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
Hello, hello. So, Dr. Pate, I would like to start by discussing a little bit about what is going on within the Idaho legislature this week. For people that may have maybe not been paying attention, there are certain legislators who want to get rid of our emergency declarations that the governor put in place, saying that we do not need them. The governor coming out late last week saying that this would have an incredibly detrimental effect on how we are dealing with COVID here in Idaho, especially in regards to the vaccine.
Well, I agree with the governor. I think, that whatever the legislature is trying to do, it's largely symbolic. First of all, I think it's a bad idea. Second of all, I don't know that constitutionally they can do this. And third of all, what I understand that they're trying to appeal to is those constituents that are upset about the restrictions that we've had. But doing away with the emergency declaration won't change the public health restrictions. And so it's largely symbolic, but unfortunately, it would end up hurting Idaho. Idaho has come through COVID so far as one of the best positioned financially through this whole pandemic. And that's in no small part to the federal assistance that we've gotten. Much or all of that would go away with ending the emergency declaration. Second, President Biden has already come out and said that the way he's going to help states with getting more vaccine out and distributed and people vaccinated is he's going to mobilize FEMA. My limited understanding of FEMA law is FEMA can't help a state if they don't have an emergency declaration. So every state in this country has an emergency declaration. We would be the only state without it. And there's good reason why all those other states have an emergency declaration. If we end ours, we will be the only state unable to receive this assistance from FEMA. Another point is that the president just indicated that he would increase the state reimbursement for the National Guard from 75% to 100%. And I am not sure. There's a lot of things we don't even know might be impacted by ending the emergency declaration, which just makes this even a more irresponsible issue for the legislature to end this, because there's things we're not sure we've even contemplated that would be damaged, but it's possible we may not get that increased reimbursement at a time when we are, a part of our vaccine strategy is to mobilize the National Guard. In fact, we've already done so. And then it appears that if they end the emergency declaration, then the governor can't use the National Guard, let alone be reimbursed for it. And finally, it is not entirely clear how vaccine is going to be allocated to the various states, but one can only imagine that if we're the only state that's saying we don't have a problem, thanks, we're fine, that might hurt our vaccine distribution. So it's incredibly bad. And unfortunately, what it's going to mean is Idaho taxpayers are going to have to make up money that they've already paid in federal taxes that our legislature is just saying, we don't want, you know, it's fine that Idahoans paid this money for the government. We don't want any of it back. Thanks. It can go to other states. And I think that's just, I think this is all incredibly ridiculous, incredibly political, and it really doesn't help Idahoans.
And I think you're right in the sense that we have as a state come out of this very much in the black compared to other states. That money would be used to do everything that you just talked about, Dr. Pate, because we wouldn't have that federal assistance. So for people who are wondering, that's exactly what would end up happening. So I want to get to the vaccine. Dr. Burgess, yesterday, Central District Health made a public plea for people to stop booking multiple vaccine appointments with different providers. First off, didn't know this was happening, but apparently it is. Why is this so important for people to not be doing this?
Well, as you can imagine, the logistics around vaccine delivery are complicated enough with the supply being somewhat unpredictable, the cold storage, having to keep people 6 feet apart, having to book their second dose, handling two different vaccines right now that have two different doses as far as how much volume is injected, and two different schedules as far as how far apart they are. So we already have all of that we're dealing with. And if we have people booking in multiple sites and then canceling and changing, it becomes even more challenging. And our biggest thing is we don't want to waste vaccine. So we have very carefully tried to make the schedule such that we have the right amount of people for the right amount of vaccine. And the other challenge is these vials are unpredictable. Sometimes they contain, for Pfizer, 5 doses, sometimes as many as 7. For Moderna, sometimes 10, sometimes as many as 12. So we're up against a lot of different logistical issues, and having people last minute cancel just adds to that and increases the risk of wasting vaccine, which none of us want to do.
And Dr. Burgess, CDH, the Central District of Health yesterday as well, asked anyone in group 1 and subgroup 2.1 to make an appointment as soon as possible before we open up to this huge group of people over the age of 65. And we're talking healthcare workers, long-term care residents, first responders, pre-K through 12 teachers and school staff, as well as daycare workers. Why do they need to get in line now?
Well, for some of those groups, they've been eligible for quite some time, but we do know the 65 and over population is a very large group of people in the state of Idaho. And so we want to try to make sure we've vaccinated as many of the people in the current group before we open up to that group. And so Monday is the first, and we really need them to get in. Now, we do know the long-term care facilities by the majority are being handled by a federal partnership with Walgreens and CVS. So hopefully the long-term care facility residents and staff are being taken care of in that manner. There's a big push for teachers, and a large number of teachers got vaccinated that very first weekend after they were made eligible. And healthcare workers, of course, have known about this for quite some time. So hopefully we've gotten the majority of those folks, but we just want to make sure they do get in before this large group is now eligible starting on Monday.
And Dr. Kern, I want to bring you into the conversation. The Magic Valley, for quite a while there, was in dire straits when it comes to the vaccine. I mean, when it came to the virus. I mean, the St. Luke's Magic Valley, in fact, having to, you know, not accept pediatric patients for a while. You also help with the Wood River Valley. How are things going now in the Magic Valley?
Yeah, we've seen the hospital numbers really stabilize of the COVID patients to a much more manageable number. We've returned to basic normal operations at this point. What we are seeing, though, is starting to catch up with the backlog of some of the surgeries and other cases that are coming into the hospital. So we continue to have a very high census, although not because of COVID, but some of the makeup from the delays in care that we were having to do when the hospital was full of COVID. And we're keeping our eye on an increasing outbreak in the Wood River Valley area with increased cases needing hospitalization. They're managing it in the Wood River Valley right now, but we're sort of just starting to keep our eye on it because we saw what happened in the beginning of the pandemic mm-hmm. in March.
Dr. Pate, before we go to break, I want to get to a listener question. So Sammy emailed us, and yesterday the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released new research that in-person school can be safe if schools take appropriate precautions. In fact, the research went on to say that in communities where there is community spread, if schools are taking appropriate precautions, there is barely any cases. In fact, it's almost 40% less cases seeing in schools than seeing in the actual community. So with that said, the research also warned that sports can be an avenue for spread. So what do you think about Idaho school decisions in the context of this research? I mean, do you think that most schools made the right gamble when they did reopen for students? But also, we know that the state just made a decision to not only allow sports, but to allow spectators of up to 40% capacity in these gyms.
Yeah. So first of all, I think the CDC report on the schools was not surprising. That is what has been our experience. And it's not just been here in Idaho. It has been across the country that if schools do take precautions, and particularly everybody wearing masks, they do not seem to be playing much of a role in transmission of the virus. The exception is what you pointed out, extracurricular activities, which most often involve sports, but can be things like cheerleading and so forth. So that has been the big exception. The CDC also just reported a huge outbreak associated with wrestling. So I continue to have strong reservations about wrestling. I think that what is important to note is a couple things. First of all, that evidence the CDC was reporting on is historic. It's based on the variants that have been circulating in the country up till that time. It also is based on the fact that the majority of schools in this country have been in hybrid. In other words, half their students. I don't think one should overinterpret these results, which I'm seeing some do, to say, oh, okay, well, now we can bring all the students back, and which would cut the distance down in half. And I think the other thing that it doesn't allow for is what would these new variants mean for us? And the CDC did say that the UK variant is expected to be the predominant circulating variant in the United States by March. And so if we bring kids back in full in-person school, we could be in for a big surprise, because if you look to the UK and see what their experience was, which was the same as us, they had not seen a lot of transmission in schools previously. But now with the UK variant, they actually do have, they are accumulating some evidence that actually it changes and schools do become a contributor to community spread with the new variant.
Our panel today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, as well as a current member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Joshua Kern, the Vice President of Medical Affairs for St. Luke's Magic Valley, and Dr. Patrice Burgess, Executive Medical Director for St. Alphonsus Health Systems and Chair of the Governor's Vaccine Advisory Committee. We have a lot of questions to get to in this segment regarding the vaccine. So Dr. Burgess, I'm going to start with Robin's question. So she wants to know about vaccinations for people with a condition that might make them more vulnerable to having a severe COVID case. She said, for instance, she had a stem cell transplant in 2002 in another state, but her medical doctor in that state is now retired. So she wants to know about whether she needs to get some type of certificate or something from her current doctor, because she also had lung damage with that procedure back in 2002.
Yeah, so we're still not at that category yet, and we haven't decided how we're going to handle that. We've really been trying to go predominantly on the honor system, which of course has its challenges, but we'll have to get back to people on whether they need to have any kind of a proof of their condition. The website, coronavirus.idaho.gov, is where we keep all of that information. So stay tuned to that. That's the group that will be coming up after the 65 plus. So we have a little bit of time to iron out the logistics around that.
And Dr. Pate, Laura from Boise says her parents are flying in from Ohio to help her during the birth of her second child. She says they're doing all the right things COVID-wise, but here's her question. She says, by the time my parents fly here, they will have each likely had their first dose of the vaccine. So my question is whether my parents can get their second vaccine in Idaho. So can you speak to how this would work with dealing with that challenge?
Yeah, so there's several things we should probably talk about. The first is the answer to the question is yes, at this time. In other words, certainly today that is possible. I don't know whether that will remain possible. That depends on the vaccine supply we're getting and how much demand relative to supply we have. If it gets even tighter, it could be that we decide to not vaccinate people outside of the state of Idaho because allocations are being based on that. But right now, there's no state policy that would prevent them from getting vaccinated here in Idaho. That does vary state to state. Some states do vaccinate from residents from out of state. Others do not. But we currently do. I guess what I would caution Laura about is I would just have her think about a few things. Number one is the risk to her parents. I don't want people to think that after one vaccine, they're good to go. There have been a number of numbers thrown out about getting one shot and having 52% effective protection. I would caution people. Those were very small numbers. We don't feel confident in those numbers. The only thing we feel confident about is that you are not going to have maximal protection after one vaccine. Mm-hmm. So if this involves her parents, it sounds like they could be in a higher risk group, particularly based on age. And now you're talking about having them fly perhaps on an airplane, go through the airport, all that, and come here with new variants emerging. I would just caution whether that's the right strategy for the parents. And then the second thing, I think, obviously, Laura's going to want to be worried about her baby. And do you want parents coming here that may have just been subjected to exposure when there's no way we can vaccinate her child? So those are all things to consider. Plus the fact that once the parents get the first vaccine in Ohio, most providers are immediately signing them up for a second appointment to get that second shot. Obviously, if they come here, that won't happen. And that means they're going to have to just see if they can get an appointment. That's certainly easier said than done. And so even though they can get vaccinated in Idaho, the question will be how easy will it be for them to get an appointment to do so? And I'm not sure that will be easy. So I would just suggest to Laura, just reconsider whether parents ought to just go ahead and get both shots in Ohio and then plan their trip to come here.
Right. Dr. Kern, Kelly wants to know, what about people who are on medications for autoimmune disease like MS? Is there any research on how the vaccine reacts with these medications?
Yeah, that would be a really important one to address with her doctor. We have been looking at the guidelines that are coming out of the National Rheumatology and Infectious Disease Societies, and it's pretty complicated, and each medication is so different that it really needs to be worked out in a plan with your doctor. But yeah, to the point of the question, several of the medications that people are on for autoimmune conditions do potentially affect the immune system in a way where more thought needs to go into when the timing of the vaccine and when the timing of your next immune modulating medication would be.
Dr. Burgess, we have a question from, I hope I'm saying this right, Rila in Salmon. She says, one thing I have heard and seen in some articles is that people who have bad allergies should not get the COVID vaccine, but they weren't specific on allergies. So she wants to know, is it medication? Is it foods? Is it pollens? But Dr. Burgess, is that even a fact?
So there are some recommendations around people with allergies. First of all, if people have significant allergies to the point of carrying an EpiPen, they've had anaphylaxis before, particularly to injectable medicines or previous vaccines, that's a group we have to be really cautious about. And Dr. Hahn, our state epidemiologist, actually recommended them not getting the Pfizer vaccine if they've had anaphylaxis. Mm. And anaphylaxis is where you have a significant problem with your blood pressure, your breathing, your heart rate, you carry an EpiPen with you, you've had to be hospitalized before. So it's a very significant allergic reaction. She has not made that same statement about the Moderna vaccine. So that is a group that we have to be extremely cautious with. Folks that have more common allergies, say food allergies or allergies to oral medications where they might get a rash or something more minor, not the significant anaphylaxis reaction, we just have those folks wait for 30 minutes after the vaccine rather than 15, so we can have all the equipment we need and be right there in case they have any difficulties. We do know that some of the reactions to vaccine allergy reactions were to polyethylene glycol. So if people have that allergy, they would not want to get the vaccine at this time until we get other vaccines that don't contain that.
And Dr. Burgess, you can request in Idaho which vaccine you want, correct?
Not necessarily. Okay. The supply is so erratic that each site is vaccinating what supply they have, but you could certainly, as you check in, find out and then reschedule if it's not the one that you want to have.
Okay. Dr. Pate, Katie wants to know how long, if at all, do you need to wait after receiving a shingles shot to get a COVID vaccine?
So the answer is you should wait at least 2 weeks, either getting the shingle shot and then getting the COVID vaccine, or getting the COVID vaccine and then getting the shingles vaccine. And I would just caution also, so the answer is 2 weeks, but I would also caution, the side effects from, you know, the sore arm, achiness, feeling kind of like you've got the flu for both of these vaccines can be, you know, rather significant for a day or two. So take that into consideration. When do you feel up for it? But 2 weeks is the answer.
And before we take a break, Dr. Kern, Sean writes, is the vaccine free for the uninsured? It's free for everyone right now, correct?
That's true. It is free for everyone. I think a lot of places are, when you have insurance, are charging your insurance for an administration fee, but the vaccine itself is already purchased and is free for everybody.
Okay. Listeners are sending in so many questions, and by far the most common has to do with the vaccine. I know we just talked about that, but I want to read a couple more questions. So Judith in Meridian just wrote in asking, are physicians calling patients to schedule a vaccine? Can we go to vaccine sites and wait in case the site has extra doses? Gary sent this in. A friend already has an appointment early in February for a vaccine. I'm 68. My doctor's office doesn't offer me any idea as to what to do. So how do I be proactive? And Dave from Eagle says, I am a healthy 70-year-old, but when and where will I be able to get a vaccine? And then Phil sent us this voice memo, so let's listen.
As a 75-year-old male with asthma/COPD, how do I secure a place in line?
Dr. Burgess, can you clear up some of the confusion for folks about this?
So I'm trying to keep track of all of the ones that you...
I know, there's so many.
That's all right. So again, the website I mentioned, coronavirus.idaho.gov, has a lot of information there, including all of the different health districts. So depending on which health district you live in, there might be some different procedures, and you can contact the health district and they can direct you to a vaccine provider when you are eligible. So the 65 plus population would be eligible February 1st, which is Monday. I know there are some providers where you can go sign up now for an appointment after February 1st. So you would just have to check with both your doctor, your health system, your health district to see what your options are. As far as physicians reaching out, I think that's happening as well. Those of us on electronic records can pull a list of folks that are in whichever category and send out information on how to sign up for the vaccine. So all of those things, I think, are the answer to most of the questions. The question about should I go to a vaccine site and just wait, I do not recommend that for several reasons. One is that could be a very fruitless wait because we're getting better and better at not having leftover vaccine. Secondly, we don't want people in crowds. That's part of the problem with the COVID vaccine compared to some of our other vaccination efforts is we have to make sure we keep people 6 feet apart and do all of the normal precautions to avoid spread of COVID. So crowding around a vaccine site would not be recommended at all, but just contacting through the mechanisms I described on getting mm-hmm. yourself signed up or on a list, depending on your district.
So Dr. Burgess, I want to add on to that because John literally just sent us this question and he says he won't be 65 until next summer, but he has been treated for cancer. So he wants to know what group he falls into for the vaccine. And I know you said it opens up on Monday for 65 and older. So where would he be in that group?
So he would be in a high-risk patient group, which would be the next group that will be after this group is completed.
Okay. Do we have a timeline as to when that would be?
Well, again, a lot of things are variable based on our vaccine supply. So we don't have a specific timeline. We're hoping that that will be in the March timeframe. But again, it just depends on if we have adequate supply. And since the vaccine is voluntary, we don't know how many of the 65 plus population will want the vaccine. So what we do is we look at when the appointments start to slow down before we open up to the next group.
So this next group after the one on Monday, if I have this clear, Dr. Burgess, well, that is that like pre-existing conditions, correct? For like 16 to 64 years old, if I read that right?
And some other essential workers as well.
Okay. Dr. Kern, Lisa wrote in, she wants to know if there is data on what percentage of national surges are coming from things like COVID fatigue. And, you know, for example, people not wearing masks, family get-togethers, people going out to restaurants, people traveling.
Yeah, I saw her question. And the reality is that a lot of it does stem from both the necessary and unnecessary sort of risks that people take. So some people are taking necessary risks because they have to go to work, they have to potentially be in the public sphere and be exposed. But other people, I think, are choosing to either downplay the importance or ignore the CDC guidelines. And so a lot of it does come down to not taking the proper precautions. But sometimes that happens as a result of things that you cannot control as an individual.
And Dr. Pate, DH in Nampa wrote in saying, as a recent recipient of my first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, I'm concerned that I have no official documentation of being vaccinated because I expect that in the future it might be necessary to show proof of vaccination in certain situations.
Well, that person should have received a card that's called a COVID-19 vaccination record card, and it's got a stamp with the CDC and the logo of the Department of Health and Human Services at the top. It's a little kind of like it's a little bit smaller than an index card, but she should have received one of those when she got her first shot. What I would do is just advise her when she goes back for her second shot with that provider, just let them know that for some reason she didn't get her card, because they should be able to fill it out for her at that time and give it to her and indicate both doses on it for her.
And then
if I could add on.
Go ahead, Dr. Burgess.
All of these are also recorded with the Idaho Immunization Registry. So if for some reason, Dr. Pate's suggestion was perfect, But if for some reason there's any other trouble, she can contact the Idaho Immunization Registry and they should be able to show proof of her vaccination.
Okay, because I have seen all those cards when people are posting that they got their shot, that they always have that card with them. I think Penelope had kind of an interesting question. She says, how are we to interact with folks who choose to not get vaccinated? How will we know who they are? I'm hoping there will be systems established so we know. For example, when we go to the dentist, when we go to the grocery store, when we go to pharmacies, this is a dilemma due to the so-called privacy issues, but could we have kind of a DMV-issued vaccinated card? I'm curious about what all of you think about this, because I think in a perfect world, we'd all like to know that. But I mean, we do have HIPAA laws for a reason.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's so much about privacy laws, because each individual is in charge of their own health information. And so, you know, if I want to disclose to you that I have or have not been vaccinated, that's not a problem. You know, I think this really isn't going to be any different than the other vaccines. Frankly, when I'm around people, I don't know if they've been vaccinated for measles. I don't know. You know, there's a whole list of diseases we could talk about. And I don't think in Idaho, it's likely that, you know, given Idaho values, that we're likely to put this on driver's licenses or anything. And it's a little bit awkward to be invited to a party and then say, okay, can I see everybody's driver's license? Like you're checking their age limit for a drink or something. So I'm not sure how practical it is. I think what is, you know, what the advice I would give, and certainly, you know, what I do is until we get the disease level down, and I mean way down, I just assume other people are infected and just act accordingly. And so I think you want to be cautious around others until we see those new daily cases per 100,000 come way down into the very low single digits, at which time we can probably conclude we are getting some kind of herd immunity. I think there'll no doubt be some businesses, like she mentioned, that are going to require their employees to be vaccinated. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some businesses who actually want to advertise that fact to appeal to people to say, hey, all of our employees are vaccinated. But I don't see that as being a requirement. There's also some discussion going on, not here in Idaho, but nationally, by some concert and sports venues that they may require vaccination for entry. So, you know, we'll see how that is. There may be some situations where you would know if you're going to that event, everybody's vaccinated. So I think for right now, you still exercise caution, assume everybody is a potential risk of exposing you, and act accordingly.
And Dr. Pate, that also goes to herd immunity, correct? I mean, in the sense that, as you mentioned, not everyone gets vaccinated for even the regular, you know, inoculations that, let's say, that we get our kids. I mean, there are people that don't do that. So we do need that herd immunity to then, you know, take care of the people that don't get vaccinated, because also, as we talked about earlier in this program today, there are some people that may not actually be able to get this vaccine, at least right now, when we talked about immunocompromised individuals.
Well, you're absolutely right, Gemma. So even that previous question that I was asked about the parents coming here for a newborn baby, I don't think any of us have the expectation that newborns are going to be vaccinated at any time in the foreseeable future. Now, once we get comfortable with pregnant women being vaccinated, and we're not totally comfortable with that yet, although I think in a lot of cases we are making the decision that the risks outweigh, or the benefits outweigh the risks. But you're right. There's going to be some people. There may be pregnant women. There may be newborns. There may be people on medications that can't take the vaccine. There may be people with these severe allergic reactions that Dr. Burgess mentioned that can't take it. So it is important that the rest of us get vaccinated. And I think a lot of people focus on, okay, well, what's that percentage going to be? Is it 75%? Is it 85%? And, you know, the truth is none of us know. And the best way to determine if we're actually achieving that herd immunity level is just follow the daily cases per 100,000. And, you know, I think, you know, right now I haven't checked recently, but I think we're in the mid-40s. We got to get down to somewhere between 1 and 3 before we can really even be considering that. So we got a long way to go. And I think right now it's just, I celebrate each additional person that gets vaccinated because that's one more step to us getting to herd immunity.
Let's take a quick break. We will continue our conversation with our medical experts next. Well, with just a few minutes left, I want to get to some questions that we received through Twitter. So Nancy tweeted, some countries in Europe are moving to require FFP2 masks. Dr. Fauci now says wear 2 masks. Is this because cloth masks aren't enough with the new variants? Dr. Pate, could you take that one?
Yeah, it is concern about the new variant. Well, I should say variants. There are 3 new variants of concern that we've already identified in the United States. There's a 4th out there that I'm sure is headed our way if it's not here already. And most of these variants do appear to be far more transmissible than what we've been dealing with before. This is not a message that masks and the cloth masks don't work. That's not the message at all. They do. It's just that in some circumstances where people are going to be in close proximity, and as we do get more of these circulating variants, it may add just some incremental added protection to, for example, what I do is wear a surgical mask closest to my face, and then I put a cloth mask over that. And so the most important thing is if we could just get everybody to wear a mask, I'll be delighted. But if you want to have the full protection, we are encouraging people to, as we get these variants, start thinking about double masking.
Can I jump in there, just a brief addition? I would encourage people to actually watch the video of Fauci talking about double masking, because it's actually more of an offhand comment than him really recommending it. The CDC guidelines haven't really changed or anything. He basically was asked the question, would it be more protective? And he said, yeah, I think it probably would be more protective, but didn't come out and say anything like everyone should be wearing double masks.
Okay. And then Dr. Kern, we also got another tweet. Someone wanting to know if an N95 or a KN95 is just as good, if not better, than double masking.
An N95, when worn properly, is probably about the same protection as a double mask. What I would caution is that many people are not wearing N95s properly. They're not fit tested. So in general, if you aren't really experienced with using an N95, if you're not fit tested, you're far better off wearing a mask that really adequately covers your face should be very well protective. I don't wear an N95 out in public. I just wear a regular mask.
And then Dr. Burgess, Nancy tweeted this. Why is the 50 to 64 age group lumped in with teenagers and other young folks in the lowest priority vaccine group?
Well, it's really a balancing act when we're looking at all the different reasons for choosing which group goes in front of another group. Obviously, if we had enough vaccine, we would just get out there and do these mass vaccination sites and vaccinate everyone. But unfortunately, we don't have enough vaccine. So if you look at the website I mentioned, the coronavirus.idaho.gov, we list the different different reasons that we make decisions. So some of it is about how the groups that are going to transmit the virus more to each other and then consequently to people that are at high risk. So we do know that that younger population tends to be the population that is a little bit less likely to wear masks and more likely to be closer than 6 feet apart and then bring that virus home to the vulnerable grandparents or people that are at higher risk. Whereas a lot of the people at higher risk are taking more precautions. So that's part of the decision process. And then also part of the process is, as you know, making sure healthcare workers, teachers are protected so that they can then care for others. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. We outline them all on the website and we're literally just doing the best that we can. And hopefully the more vaccine we get, we can quickly get to all the groups and get everybody that wants one a vaccine.
Dr. Burgess, will you give that website address again for people who may just be joining us?
Yeah, absolutely. It's coronavirus.idaho.gov. And there's a vaccine tab there. When you get to the front page, you'll see statistics, but there's a vaccine tab where you can get more details.
Okay. And then,
and Gemma,
go ahead, Dr. Pate.
Hey, I just want to offer a quick recognition of Dr. Burgess. She's been chairing this vaccine committee, and I think few people have an appreciation for how difficult and how time-consuming that job is. And obviously, she has a day job. And no one is going to agree with every specific decision that committee has made. But I do want to commend Dr. Burgess for her leadership, the balancing act, trying to balance all these different interests as well as a limited supply. And I think we should all be very grateful to her.
I would second that. Yeah, absolutely. We have about 2 minutes left. And so, Dr. Pate, I want to ask one question. And this is, how concerned should we be about these new variants? Because frankly, it just makes me more anxious, right? I mean, I was feeling fairly good. Like, we mask, we do all those things. And now, I mean, really, the anxiety level has gone up.
Yeah. Well, obviously, there's reason for concern with the new variants, but I don't think that should be keeping anybody up at night. I don't worry incessantly about it. First of all, we continue to get some good information that it does appear for most of these variants that our current vaccines are going to be protective. Second, this new mRNA technology, it really allows us to change the vaccine very quickly if we need to. I think the big message about the variants is this is the argument to all of those people that we talked about last year, Gemma, who said, you know, we just need to get young people out there. Let's lock up the old people at home. Let's get young people back. Let's let it spread. Let's get to herd immunity. Well, this is what happens when you let this virus spread. When it is replicating and spreading to over 100 million people, that's 100 million times that virus is changing itself, and you can end up with this. So the answer is not for us to panic. The answer is for us to start taking this seriously and do what we can to decrease the transmission and get everybody vaccinated we can, because when we do those things, we're not going to see all these variants emerging.
Well, I appreciate all that all three of you do. I agree. I hope that after almost a year of this, that people will take this seriously. Wear a mask, get vaccinated if you can. Thank you, honestly, to all of you, Dr. David Pate, Dr. Patrice Burgess, Dr. Joshua Kern. I don't think we could get through this with our sanity intact without everything that all of you are doing. So thank you very much. Of course, we'll have our medical experts back next week, but thank you again.
Thanks, Gemma.
And I want to remind all of you that we are still looking for questions for our Wanna Know Idaho podcast. If you have one, send it to us on our website. I'm Gemma Gaudet. It is Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.